Hello, listeners. Just a quick warning to say there's a little bit of strong language this week because we're speaking to a chef and everyone knows they swear a lot. Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Europeans. I am Dominic in Amsterdam, and I'm speaking to my lovely friend, Katie Lee, in Paris. You're actually in Paris this week, aren't you?
I am in Paris, where it's been a kind of crazy week as a journalist, actually. We've had this horrible terrorist attack down in the south, and this big political scandal breaking with Nicolas Sarkozy getting charged. Do you remember him?
No.
Yeah, you do. He was the bling bling guy, loved spending money, that kind of thing.
No, I do. I'm kidding. I just felt like ruining your story.
Well, you didn't, because I'm carrying on. Sarkozy got taken into custody over these allegations that his election campaign took literal suitcases of cash from the Libyan dictator, Colonel Gaddafi.
Not a good week for him.
But you and me had a very good week.
Woohoo!
We've been nominated for a prize! Very exciting. We have been nominated for the European Parliament's Charlemagne Youth Prize. Basically as close to Eurovision, I think, as you and I are ever going to get. So it's a huge deal.
Speak for yourself.
Oh yeah, sorry. I forgot I was in the presence of a singer. We should probably tell people what it is.
So the European Charlemagne Prize for Youth has been awarded every year since 2008 to a project from one of the EU member states. And it has to do various things. It should foster a sense of international and pan-European understanding. It should develop a shared sense of European identity and integration and provide role models for young people living in Europe, which I think, Katie, you and I are perfect for. Despite your drinking.
Despite my drinking and your creepy clown costumes. You basically just have to be under 30 and doing some kind of cool project around Europe, really. We have been nominated as the Netherlands entry.
Big thank you to the Dutch MEPs who chose us to be the Dutch representatives, despite the fact that my Dutch is still pretty rubbish. So I'm really touched. Thank you.
We are really excited. So I'm going to Aachen in May. For the big glitzy ceremony. Do you think I should get Susie Menkers, the Vogue international editor from last week's episode, to style me for the big day?
Such a good idea. I mean, we want to win, and I feel like we should. But even if we don't, it'll be a really nice way to meet other inspiring young Europeans.
I like how you said other inspiring Europeans, like we're really inspiring when I can barely get myself dressed in the morning. Coming up, listeners, we have a wonderful guest for you. The Michelin-starred chef, Christian Puglisi. I think he might have just taken the prize from Alexandra Pascalidou for the most European person to appear on this podcast. Alexandra is Greek and Swedish and was born in Romania. Christian is a Norwegian-Italian chef who works in Denmark. And you might have seen him in the new Netflix series, Ugly Delicious, talking about pizza. We've given him a call to talk about everything from how his mixed national heritage comes out in the delicious food he makes to how he keeps his restaurants as environmentally friendly as possible. We had a really, really great chat with him that I think made us both quite hungry.
Yeah, it definitely made me hungry. Pizza is my favourite food in the world, so whenever that's being talked about, I can't stop salivating. There's a lovely image for you.
After a good week for us, should we go into our regular feature, Good Week, Bad Week?
Let's do that with our new jingle. Can you put it in?
Good week, bad week.
I think that might be the most repulsive of the jingles yet.
It's to immortalise your beautiful singing forever. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
Kick us off then, Dominic. Who's been having a bad week?
I would argue that it's been a pretty bad week for Cambridge Analytica. And actually, to be frank, I think they're going to be having quite a few bad weeks for quite a long time now. So if you've been living under a rock, then you may have missed that last week, The Observer, which is the Sunday edition of the celebrated British paper, The Guardian, along with Channel 4 and The New York Times, unleashed a story that they've been working on for over a year with the help of a whistleblower from this questionable company, Cambridge Analytica. They're an organization of data analysts who were employed famously by Steve Bannon during the 2016 American presidential election. And the company described themselves as using data to change audience behavior, although the whistleblower described them as a full-service propaganda machine. bit more on the nose. There's so much to talk about in this story, and it may be too much to unpick in Good Week, Bad Week. So I really recommend everyone checking out The Guardian articles and supporting the tireless work of this journalist, Carol Cadwalader, who's had quite a lot of abuse on Twitter over the last year. A few of the headlines are as follows. Cambridge Analytica have been accused of harvesting the data of 50 million Facebook accounts on an unprecedented scale. They did this by getting thousands of users to join an app, and then somehow they were able to access the data of not only this user, but also all of their friends, including things like status updates and even some personal messages. So both Cambridge Analytica and Facebook are now potentially in trouble with both the UK and the US authorities. In the case of the UK, Alexander Nix, who actually was the CEO, he's been suspended. Maybe by time of broadcast, he's been fired. I don't know. He told a parliamentary inquiry recently that the company did not have or use private Facebook data. This is now seemingly not true. So he could be in breach of parliament, which I think might mean he has to pay a fine. Like, it's not the biggest news. The bigger news is that Cambridge Analytica have influenced quite a few elections, including the Brexit vote and the American election. The Electoral Commission in the UK were already looking into them, and Robert Mueller is thought to be looking into them as part of his special counsel investigation into Russian collusion. I was interested, Katie, I don't know if you were too, in the use of Cambridge in the name of the organisation as a way of giving the company academic legitimacy.
Yeah, I like that. It does definitely add some street cred. Well, we both went to Cambridge University. Maybe we should make more use of that to make people think that we're clever.
Or should we call ourselves the Cambridge Europeans?
Yeah, we absolutely should. It's been quite interesting this week. I don't know if your Facebook timeline is like mine, but mine is kind of sprinkled with people this week announcing that they're leaving Facebook, saying, you know, see you in the real world. I don't want my data here. Have you been seeing that as well?
Yeah, a little bit, but not that much, actually. And I was thinking about it today that if people are leaving Facebook, they also have to leave Instagram because Instagram's owned by Facebook.
Would now be a good time to tell everyone to follow our pages on Facebook and Instagram?
Yes, just as the algorithms were working in our favour.
We are posting some really nice stuff there. Facebook.com/Europeans Podcast and Instagram @Europeans Podcast. If you're going to hang around, you might want to look at those pages.
And if not, we respect your decision, but we are not moving to Snapchat.
No, we're too old for that. We don't understand how it works.
Who's it been a good week for, Katie?
It's been a good week for the spread of American culture into France. There've been a lot of headlines this week and a lot of soul searching in France because of new figures suggesting that more hamburgers sold in France over the past year than the classic sandwich, the jambon beurre, which is basically a buttered baguette with some ham shoved into it, and sometimes you can throw in a couple of gherkins too. Yeah, so for the first time ever, burgers have taken over. Quelle horreur. I've only lived here in France for about 3 years, and the France that I've known has always been full of burgers, but I've got colleagues who've said, you know, this is a fairly new thing. It is really different from how it was 10 years ago. Back then, you hardly ever saw burgers on the menu of restaurants, even though it seems quite hard to believe, because now it's a staple on any bistro menu. You know, like, there's always a burger there, burger and chips. And McDonald's, my God, France loves McDonald's. It's got one of the highest concentrations of McDonald's in Europe, actually. 21.2 per million people.
I mean, therefore, it's definitely been a good week for McDonald's.
It's been a good week for McDonald's, but they didn't need the advertising. Foreigners are often surprised by just how much French people love McDonald's, given the stereotypes of being really snobby about food. But they absolutely love it. It's always chock full. I live less than a minute's walk from a McDonald's and it is constantly rammed with people. But there have been, you know, there's regular conversations in France about whether local culture is being invaded by American influence, you know, whether the kids are listening to too much English pop music and stuff like that. And I think it's probably true that France is a bit slower to open up to international food trends compared to other countries, maybe. Like, the burger did come here pretty late. It's not really been one of the early adopters on that. And recently we've seen the same thing over and over again. We're seeing avocado toast has recently turned up here in France, which the hipsters are getting very excited about.
Thank goodness for that. How have you been coping without them?
I don't know, but you're coming to visit me soon, which means you can come and try it out and see if it's up to scratch.
I can't wait.
Vive la France!
Oh, we say vive la roi in one of the operas I'm doing at the moment. We shout it, even though the rest of it's in German and Italian.
That's weird. Very European, though.
Oh, and actually, I want to talk about... Sorry, I know I always have like an anecdote about my opera life, but that is because it's all I'm doing at the moment.
Opera, schmopera.
But one of the shows I'm doing at the moment, Das Floss der Medusa, there's been one man who has booed as soon as the show ends, before anyone starts clapping. every single night, including the dress rehearsal.
That man is my hero. Wait, including the dress rehearsal? That means he's an insider. He must know someone.
Well, he's somehow connected. And it's the same man, definitely, because it's the same pitch and voice. Either that or there are like seven incredibly similar sounding men who have the same criticism of the show. It's really weird that he would spend the money to come to every night, because it's not cheap going to the opera, and torture himself by sitting through it every night just to boo once. He just goes, boo! And then everyone starts clapping and there's no more booing.
What would you do if it was me?
Oh my God, that'd be such a scandal.
I think you'd probably just be really impressed that I can boo in a really low man's voice.
I'd be like, you should be an opera singer.
I've been told that previously, actually. You might not believe it, but it's true. How's all your show been going with your clowning about?
It's been going well, although I'm a bit annoyed with like how much makeup I wear and how difficult it is to take off. Because for the clowning about show, Trouble in Tahiti, I'm obviously wearing white makeup. And for Das Floss de Medusa, I have like a skull face on. So I have bits of black makeup. Not blackface. I just wear little patches of black to make my face look like a skull.
Yeah, I know the kind of effect you mean, like classic 5-year-old Halloween costume kind of look.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of can't be bothered to take it off in between because it's so difficult to get black paint off your face and white paint.
You should post an Instagram of how nice your face looks afterwards. It'll look like that time that you played that sick person on Scottish Island that we talked about last week.
It's difficult to know what's the makeup, the residue of the makeup, and what's my actual tiredness. I did actually post a photo of myself on our Instagram voting today, and I put an emoji over my face because I look too horrible.
I'm just looking at our Instagram. I can't see it.
It's a story.
Oh my God, are we doing Instagram stories now?
I've been doing stories for ages.
Have you? I don't understand Instagram. I'm too old.
It's what all the kids do.
Oh, well done for doing stories. That's going to really bring in the utes.
I'm not sure it does, actually, but oh well.
It's time for the delicious main course of this podcast, Dominic. Should we call up our wonderful chef?
Let's do that. I'm so excited.
I have become a little bit obsessed with this new Netflix show, Ugly Delicious. It's not a perfect TV show, but I do really like the way that it talks about the overlap between food and identity and how American food in particular has been shaped by immigration over the years. It's been really, really interesting. Episode one of this show is all about pizza and who gets to decide, if anyone, what makes a pizza authentic? What does the crust have to be like? What kind of cheese can you use? Whether or not you're committing some kind of crime if you put pineapple on top, and so on. And as part of that episode, they talked to Christian Puglisi. Is that how you pronounce it?
Puglisi, yeah.
Puglisi. Christian is a chef and restaurateur in Copenhagen. He owns several businesses, including a Michelin-starred restaurant, Relay. But the one we're really interested in is his pizza restaurant, Based.
He's reacting against the conservatism of this organisation that protects the true Neapolitan pizza. And I really am looking forward to talking to him more about that, because whilst I agree with him that it shouldn't be so strict and that it doesn't make sense to import products from there over to Denmark because they won't be fresh anymore, I do think they're doing something right in Naples, because when I went there for a pizza a few years ago, it was just the best pizza I'd had in my life. It felt like there was something magic in it. Like MSG or something.
I was going to say, that's what I would call magic. Delicious MSG. Maybe that's what it is.
Well, let's give him a call and see what he says.
Let's do that. Christian is a real pleasure to talk to. He sacrificed part of a rare night off to give us a ring from his home in Copenhagen. Is your food, is it Danish? Is it Italian? Is it Norwegian? Is it all of those things? Is it none of those things? Where's it from?
It doesn't have a passport. Very much as myself, I am an immigrant. I'm born in Italy. I've moved to Denmark. My mom is Norwegian. I've worked in Spain. I've worked in France. I'm influenced by all those things, and so is the food. It has inspiration from different places, but it is essentially its own being. You know, it's an expression of ideas that I make together with my colleagues and my partners, and that's it. I don't like the geographical definition. I think it's very limited.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk these days about the new Nordic cuisine. So would you argue that your restaurants aren't part of that? You don't see yourself as part of that movement, or is it inevitable because you're in Copenhagen, you are?
We're put in that category, but I've never wanting to be a part of it. I think the beauty about food and gastronomy is that it's been this way of cultures to meet and merge and share ideas and knowledge and traditions. And I really like to think that we also are capable of creating new traditions for the future and not only can look back. So this idea of just limiting yourself to this is the only things you can use based on a geographical point of view, I think it's a bit strange also because we all know that not even potatoes are essentially local, right? They come from South America.
Right.
So that brings us nicely to the fact that you decided to go against the strict Associazione Verace Pizza Napolitana and make your own mozzarella in Denmark. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
I realized when I was researching the real Napolitan pizza, the absolute quality from fresh mozzarella is in its freshness. So it doesn't make sense to import it to Denmark to then claim to do an authentic way. What I think would make sense was to do something here locally that you will not be able to get in Naples. And then in that sense, doing something authentic.
So you literally got your own cows and learned how to make your own mozzarella on YouTube. Is that right?
It's a bit of a stretch. And it didn't go in that order, first of all.
I saw it on the Netflix show.
I didn't learn everything from YouTube. I think that was edited. My point is that all the information is out there. Like, I bought a Rubik cube for my kid and, you know, it doesn't take me 10 minutes before I start thinking I should look this up on YouTube because I have no idea how to solve this. There's no chance in hell I'm going to be able to do this. And that doesn't mean cheating. I'm just studying it.
So what other kind of things do you look up on YouTube? Is there anything else recently you remember thinking, how do I do this?
There's another Napolitan thing called sfogliatelle, which is like a pastry. It's almost like a filo sort of dough that then is rolled very, very, very thinly and rolled. And then it's stuffed with cream of ricotta and semolina and cooked and stuff like this. And I looked it up because I've heard about it. I didn't really know what the process was. And for me, it took me 10 minutes to see how the process was done.
So your dad is from Sicily, your mom is Norwegian, you have lived in Denmark since you were a really little kid. What did you eat growing up, mostly?
I mostly ate Italian food. My mom moved to Sicily and lived there for a couple of years before they had me. So she lived in Italy a total of 13 years, and she sort of started cooking Italian food there, and then that was sort of the food that we would eat. Sometimes a little stint of something else, but normally that was the food that I grew up with. And when coming as an immigrant to this country, to Denmark, I had very strong feelings about the food from where I came from. Until my mid-20s, I was really bad at having the same approach to Italian food. There was only one right way of doing everything. The one true way to make a carbonara, or the one true way of doing something. And I think I was very much holding on to that as a teenager, because I felt it was a very important part of myself that I wanted to keep on to. At one point, though, as I reached a little bit of maturity, at least in the mid-20s, I started to see that actually my mixed background was not a problem for me, because this was not only in food, that was obviously in everything, right? As everybody that has been in this situation, I have sort of lived in Denmark being from somewhere else, and when I would go back to Italy, I would be the guy from Denmark, right? So it's like this, you just try and find out where you belong. And I was very much focusing on wanting to be Italian. And then at one point I realized, you know what? Because I've lived now maybe 15 years in another country, I can see that this is total bullshit. I mean, that doesn't make sense that you say that or you think that or you guys do this. You know what I mean? Because when I opened Relay was very clearly a not Italian restaurant. Really tried to make it a not Nordic restaurant. I really wanted to be myself. I wanted to put myself into it.
Why do you think people get so passionate and so angry even about infringements of these very strict rules about what makes a pizza a pizza?
You have something that is, on one hand, the most Italian thing and the most Napolitan thing, but also probably the most internationally available piece of food. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's no corner of the world where you cannot get pizza. The quality of it will vary heavily. And I think that that's a little bit of a part of it, no? Because it becomes, from Italy's point of view, it's this way of looking out into the world and saying, well, yeah, but we do it better. There is so many elements of putting pineapples on pizza or doing some crazy stuff and shrimps. And I don't know if you heard about the thing that brought me on TV, on Danish TV last week, about a pizza conflict, as they called it, in Italy. I don't know if you heard about that.
No.
Carlo Cracco, a very famous Italian chef that has been doing MasterChef, he opened a new place where he's doing a pizza margherita his own way. Whole grain flour and mozzarella's put cold on top and this basil seed, basil, and people have it going absolutely nuts all over the place. And it was to the point where I was brought into Danish TV to talk about it. I mean, it's totally fucking nuts. Yeah. I think that really shows how many sentiments and how many feelings are invested in this. Not only at a national level, in Napoli, you even have areas of Napoli. And if you're outside Napoli, as in 15 minutes away, you're not doing really Neapolitan pizza. That's what we're talking about. So there's such a pride in local connection with the foods that you do that I think is great in some senses, but sometimes it goes overboard.
What's the best pizza you've ever had?
For me, the best pizza is the one that Franco Pepe does, which is actually outside Naples. You wouldn't be able to tell that it's not a Neapolitan pizza. It's in the details. But he puts personality in his. And in terms of flavor and texture, it's outstanding. And this person has essentially given new birth to this small village in the middle of fucking nowhere, half an hour away from Naples, where shops have started to thrive again and stuff like this, simply because he just puts 500 people through that place every night and you have to stand in line for a good 3 hours to just get a pizza.
What? That's crazy.
A pizza that costs maybe €6.
Okay.
And that's really something that I think is outstanding. That I like the story of something that has a gastronomical importance that is so high. Like, it's so important on a cultural level and gastronomical level, but in Naples you can buy for €4 or €5. It's not some crazy, inaccessible, exclusive food for the rich. It is food of the people, and people have an opinion about it. I think that's great.
Your restaurants pride themselves on being sustainable. You won the Sustainable Restaurant Award 2 years in a row. Does this cause you greater expense, or do you actually find that it pays off as a business model?
If you start saving water, it's not going to cost you much. Or if you start thinking about how you spend your electricity, that's not going to cost you much. I think it's just basic taking responsibility for things. The good thing is that today we live in a time where these things are appreciated and will soon be mandatory, in the sense that they will be the standard in the years to come. It just happens to be that it's also something that is good for business. I think it's very important to have a genuine curiosity about how we impact the world we're in. I want to be in a place that I can be proud of.
Do you think there's anything that the EU or individual countries could do to help restaurateurs follow your example and cook more sustainably?
What the EU could really help with was to look at fishery quota laws, very big and intricate problems that we have with that. And our seas being totally overfished and us not being able to put anything on the table in the years to come. And the level of pollution and very bad animal welfare that it produces all throughout Europe. This lack of diversity that is key to our way of cooking. We need diversity to cook great food.
Have there been specific foods, I don't know, maybe some fish that you've actually had to decide you can't serve because you haven't been able to find a kind of an ethical, sustainable way of sourcing them?
The amounts of fish that we serve are extremely limited, as in the types and varieties of fish that we serve, that we know that we can live up to serving, that they're sustainably sourced. It's really scary. Like, there's really not a lot of fish that you can eat with a completely fine conscience once you know about what the state of things are.
We try to be quite critical on this podcast about topics, but it seems like you are making that quite hard for us because you seem to have a very good ethical barometer going there. My final question is, do you have anything that you feel disappointed that you're not able to do, that something you're ethically conflicted about as a restaurateur that is just impossible to do?
You started off saying that we pride ourselves on being a sustainable restaurant. I mean, that's not true. We're trying as good as we can, because to be truly sustainable, you should probably sit on a stone and barely breathe.
Yeah.
We will have an impact no matter what we do. the more I inform myself about things, the more I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do. You know, we can just do our best.
I don't know about you, Katie, but after that, I definitely need a happy ending because I'm feeling sad that I'm not eating pizza right now.
You're obsessed with pizza. I remember you talked a few weeks ago about how it was pizza that broke your pledge to be vegan for the whole January.
Yeah.
That's how you can be tempted and corrupted. It's good to know.
I don't know how vegans do it. Anyway, so this happy ending starts 7 years ago when a plucky 19-year-old German decided, actually, maybe I shouldn't describe him as plucky. I don't know he's plucky. He could have been morose.
He's probably plucky.
I didn't know him. But a morose 19-year-old German called Leonard Tai donated some of his DNA to the donor register. Now, the chances of a full DNA match with a patient are remarkably small, but 7 years later, Leonard, who is a professional footballer on loan from his German team, playing in the Netherlands for VVV Venlo, gets the call saying that there has been a match with an acute leukemia patient. So Leonard therefore decided to take the week off training and miss a match against PSV Eindhoven last week in order to donate blood to be used in a stem cell treatment that could save the life of this patient. This is obviously very good news for said patient and could potentially save their life. Also good news is that the publicity of this generous action has led to 6,000 new applications to the Dutch Centre for Stem Cell Donors,
aww,
which is really amazing. And to top it all off, Leonard seems like such a nice man. He doesn't see himself as a hero. He doesn't really want to talk about it with the press, but he agreed to do one press conference. And he said, yeah, I'm not a hero. There was no question as to whether I would do it. Obviously, I would if I can save someone's life. And he said also, I'd rather be in the news because of my performance on the field. But if it leads to many new donors, then it's all worth it.
He does sound perfect. What is it with all the perfect men on this podcast this week?
I know. I don't know. They also named Leonard the man of the match for the match that he missed.
Oh.
And he received a minute's applause from the crowd.
My heart is melting. Nice one, Leonard.
I know.
We do very thoroughly encourage the giving of all kinds of organs and blood and bits and bobs on this podcast, as you might know from our previous episode about the ethics of organ transplants and things like that. But did you know, I tried to give blood in France and was told I can't because I'm British.
That's so racist.
It's really racist. But this was last year. We're doing a new company blood run, so I've just had the bad memory of it revived all over again. But basically last year, I tried to go and give blood, thinking, oh, I'm so nice, giving blood. Turned up and they're like, thank you very much, Mademoiselle Lee, for coming, but you can't give blood because you're British and you might have mad cow disease.
Oh my God. Wouldn't you know if you had mad cow disease? Mad cow disease. Mad cow. Maybe I've got it.
You would think so. But there is a blanket ban on anyone that lived in Britain for more than a year between 1980 and 1996.
Oh, that's nice of them. Is that why burgers took such a long time to get to France? Because they were so scared of cows?
Oh, that's such a good point. Maybe it is. I'll do some more digging on this and get back to you.
Yeah, please do. I'm also not allowed to give blood because I'm gay.
I mean, yeah, I just get really angry about that. That's all over Europe, isn't it, that policy? Well, maybe it isn't.
I'm not sure, because they're thinking about changing it in the UK. I know that there is a campaign for it. So I imagine it's country by country. But it's ridiculous. You can have HIV if you're straight as well.
It is insane.
Were you like a tiny bit pleased when they told you couldn't give blood because you were a bit scared?
No, well, the last time I gave blood in England, it was taken by a quite handsome man, so I really enjoyed it.
Oh, you get your thrills where you can, don't you, Katie?
I do.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Europeans. Please tell all your friends about it. Go and shout it from the hills like those cows and sheep on our happy ending jingle.
We've been receiving lovely messages about that jingle. Particularly, I want to say hello to Anne in Eastern Germany, who said that, what did she say?
She said the final bar made her snort on the tube and she got some looks from judging commuters.
I really like the idea that we are having a big impact on people's commutes. Before Anne, we already made Diana in Bulgaria miss several stops on the Sofia metro system because she was laughing too hard at our podcast.
I love that we started out like trying to make a really serious podcast about Europe.
There's enough serious podcasts about Europe. There aren't any fun ones. It's our niche.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think we should give ourselves a big pat on the back for ruining everyone's journeys. Another bit of housekeeping. A listener has pointed out the fact that I accidentally asked all of you to send in nude pictures at the end of last week's episode when we were talking about the Dutch politician who did a sort of nude advertising campaign. Just to avoid any doubt, please do not send us nudes. Send us pictures of your pizza instead. Thank you.
Aren't you a bit disappointed that we didn't get any nudes?
Maybe a tiny bit.
We will be back with you next week with more news from Europe. And in the meantime, have a good week. It's springtime. Let's hope it feels like it soon.
Get out there, run into the fields, and shout about the Europeans podcast.
Bye.